Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Mokbil Yabro, filling in for John Tanza here in Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the rest of the region this Thursday, October 17th, 2024. Unity State Government Press Secretary Ko Kwang says flooding in Mayom County is extreme.
Today, we have realized that almost 8 fayams of the 11 fayams have submerged into the water.
And the head of the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group, Mohamed Dagalo, has said the Egyptian military has conducted airstrikes against RSF troops, an accusation Egypt's government has denied. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Authorities in South Sudan's Unity State are calling for humanitarian assistance to address the crisis caused by flooding. The state government says over 80% of the state is submerged by water. Mamer Abraham Kwat reports for VOA from Malakal.
Luca Chirey, commissioner of Mayom County in Unity State, says the flood that hit his county this year is the worst recorded for over 120 years. He says the most affected people are lactating mothers, elderly, and persons living with disabilities.
We need humanitarian assistance. All international NGOs, national NGOs, government, national unity in Juba, our government in Unity State, Bentiu, and the wise the chief of executive, Jesse Rebintop, to come down and least help us with the needed materials, like non-food items and food items.
The commissioner says there's no medical care because airstrips are flooded, making hard for the county to receive medical supplies.
In the health sector, we're looking for medical assistance because people now are exposed to this flooding. People living with diabetes, high blood pressure, and chronic disease, they have no access to medical attention. Even children, they have no vaccine for them.
Agustina Jal, the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission coordinator in Mayom County, says people are not receiving any support from the humanitarian community. He says projects that encourage flood-resistant crops such as rice should be introduced to help the people adapt to living in flood-prone areas.
No, anybody can give them anything, especially the humanitarian. They did not give the displaced people anything. Even the government did not give anything to the people. The whole contribution of the maize and the sorghum, they are now occupied by the flood. If there is a rice or something that can change this contribution, that will be good for the community.
Ko Kwang is the press secretary in the office of the governor of Unity State.
Like I can say maybe 80% of the land in Unity State is covered by water because most of the important towns where the people reside so much have submerged into water also. And when it comes to Mayom, that was the only county that was not submerged by the flooding for the last 4 years. And today we have realized that almost 8 fayams of the 11 fayams have submerged into the water.
He says the state government is relocating people to high ground and providing security. Kwa says the people need excavators to construct dikes to stop floods from advancing. South Sudan's National Ministry of Water Resources and Irrigation this year said on social media that the level of water in Bentiu was constant, while it was increasing in Mangala, Bor, and Malakal. For VOA News, I am Amira Bramcourt, reporting from Upper Nile State's capital, Malakal.
The impeachment trial of Kenya's deputy president, Rigathi Gachagua, was thrown into disarray today after his lawyer said he had fallen ill and was in the hospital. My colleague Yehais Wahib spoke with VOA's Nairobi bureau chief, Mariama Diallo, a little while ago for the latest.
Well, Yehais, Kenya's embattled deputy president, Rigathi Gachagua, is reportedly at the hospital. This comes obviously as he was scheduled to testify today on his own impeachment trial around 2:30 p.m. local time. I have to say, at first, they didn't know where he was. The Senate Speaker was asking where he was because they had basically suspended the proceedings and said that they will resume at 2:30 and that they, when they came, they were expecting the DP to testify. So when he was asking where is he, I think even his team of lawyers did not know where he was at first, and then later on, and when time was ticking, they said that he had fallen ill. So, after that, I think they kind of consulted with each other, both sides, and then decided that the proceedings will actually resume around 5 p.m. local time, which is just around now, when the speaker said that, you know, it will have to, the chamber will come back, and they do expect the DP to take the stand, because as he said, this is, quote, a time-bound process. It is so ordered, meaning that they have to actually go on with the proceedings.
So Mariama Gachagua has denied all the charges and no criminal proceedings have been launched against him. But with this impeachment thing, he will, what, automatically be removed from office if the Senate approves his impeachment?
Well, I actually asked that question today to an analyst, this governance and analyst and lawyer. I asked him that same question. What is going to happen, that, you know, once they vote to impeach him, they do need a two-third majority in order to remove him. But he said that if that's approved, yes, he will immediately be removed from his functions. I think the president will have to submit another name, another official to replace, to possibly replace Gachagua. But he will have to submit that to Parliament. And I think Parliament has, you know, maybe I think 40 to 60 days maybe to approve it. But what the analyst told me was also the fact that the Senate, Parliament is actually having a sitting, I think, on Friday. So it's possible that if they're able to vote on this today and get it done, the president might nominate somebody right away, and that they might actually, the chamber might decide, yes, they can either approve it or not approve it, but they are trying to do it. They could try to do it before next Tuesday, because Monday is officially a holiday. But at the same time, I think the analyst also said that Gachagua does have, you know, the right to go back to the courts and maybe try to appeal some of this the decisions. But that could take a longer process.
Would this be the first deputy president to be ousted in this manner since impeachment was introduced in Kenya?
And it is historic, because I think the constitution was changed. Being able to actually impeach a government official was introduced in the constitution. But nobody, they've been able, actually for that reason, because it was new in the constitution, they've been able to impeach governors and other people, but never really at the level of the DP or the president. But it is in the constitution, actually, that anybody, any official, people don't feel like they're doing the job the way that they're supposed to do, can be impeached. So, but this is the first time for a DP, for sure, in Kenya. It's historic.
That was Mariama Diallo, our Nairobi bureau chief, speaking with VOA's Yehei Swahib. Just a few minutes ago, Reuters News reported that Kenya's Senate will proceed with impeachment hearings against Deputy President Gachagua. It will hold a vote on whether to dismiss him on today, despite his absence from the proceedings after his lawyer said he had fallen ill. The war in Sudan has escalated in recent weeks as the National Army has deployed its superior air power to help it regain some territory in around the capital, Khartoum, and to pound other areas occupied by the rival Rapid Support Forces. Mohamed Degalo, the commander of the RSF, has accused Egypt of helping the Sudanese army. Angie Omar has more from Cairo.
In a video message, the head of the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group, Mohamed Degalo, said the Egyptian military has conducted air strikes against RSF troops. In the video, Degalo expressed condolences for RSF soldiers he described as treacherously murdered by Egyptian aircraft, suggesting a deliberate campaign against his forces. Degalo gives a special greeting to those he called the heroes of the Battle of Mount Moya. He says the conflict resembles the Battle of Karbala, targeting unarmed civilians heading to Saudi Arabia, which he says also was struck by the Egyptian Air Force. He says the RSF remained silent for a long time, hoping that those responsible would wake up and retreat. Unfortunately, he says the Egyptians are persistent, and now they have entered the battle. Degalo alleges that Egypt is not only conducting airstrikes, but also the Islamic State, IS, is training and equipping the Sudanese armed forces with drones and U.S.-made weapons. Washington has repeatedly called for a ceasefire in Sudan and has tried to get the two sides to negotiate. The Egyptian Ministry of Foreign Affairs dismissed Dagalo's claims, saying that Egypt is committed to halting the war and protecting civilians. The ministry called for the international community to examine any evidence that supports Dagalo's assertions, which Egypt called unfounded. However, Egypt has historically enjoyed a close relationship with the Sudanese military, led by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. Former Egyptian Army General Mohammed Abdel Wahed explains what may be behind RSF claims. General Abdel Wahed says Dagalo's statements have no basis in truth, and this is not the first time he accused other countries of aiding the Sudanese army. He says Dagalo has made such claims multiple times since the war started in April 2023. Abdel Wahed says whenever the rapid support forces face setbacks, Dagalo accuses other countries of supporting the Sudanese army or even spreads rumors to create divisions within the Sudanese army itself. The United States has recently imposed sanctions on individuals associated with the RSF to curtail their ability to procure weapons and support its military operations. One of those sanctioned was senior RSF leader Al-Ghani Hamdan Dagalo Moussa, the younger brother of the RSF commander. Joseph Siegel leads the Africa Center for Strategic Studies Research in Washington. He says Al-Ghani Dagalo also has made accusations that Egypt provided the Sudanese army with U.S.-made weapons. He says, however, the allegations seem like an effort to distract from his own role.
And Al-Ghani's role as a key procurement leader is in direct violation of the UN Security Council resolution prohibiting the arming of any faction in Sudan. His actions and the actions of the RSF have directly contributed to the RSF's Arab militias' ethnic cleansing that's taking place in the Darfur region against African communities from that part of Western Sudan. This includes the ongoing siege of El Fasher, and a city that's been under siege, with estimates that some 75,000 people are currently facing famine.
The civil war in Sudan, which erupted in April 2023, following a failed transition to a civilian rule, is one of the world's largest humanitarian catastrophes. Over 10 million people have been displaced, and the country faces widespread severe hunger and disease. The United Nations has warned of famine in parts of Darfur. This is Angie Omar, reporting for VOA News from Cairo.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, a federal grand jury in California on Wednesday indicted two men from Sudan. Listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America, I'm Mukbil Yabaro. A federal grand jury in California on Wednesday indicted two men from Sudan for tens of thousands of cyber attacks on businesses, hospitals, and government organizations in the United States and overseas. Ahmed Salah Yusuf Omar and Ala Salah Yusuf Omar were charged in the U.S. District Court in Central California with conspiracy and computer damage caused by the group Anonymous Sudan from 2023 to 2024. The group carried out distributed denial of service attacks to knock targets offline. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles, the group carried out more than 35,000 attacks. The victims included the U.S. Department of Defense, Justice Department, State Department, and companies such as Microsoft. The U.S. Attorney's Office says earlier this year, investigators managed to disable the program that Anonymous Sudan used in its attacks. Dai Bing, China's deputy permanent representative to the United Nations says external armed forces and mercenaries should withdraw from Libya as soon as possible. He made the comments at a recent Security Council briefing on the UN support mission in Libya. David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi what's behind China's position.
I think China has looked at Libya. It's seen Libya as a strategic country in the Middle East and North Africa. It borders the Mediterranean and Tunisia, Algeria, Egypt, Niger, and Chad. So what China is trying to do here is to act as a neutral arbiter in the crisis, because this mission has been going on for a long time. And ever since Gaddafi left, there doesn't really seem to be any kind of stability. China wants to place itself as aloof, separate from Russia and UAE and Egypt, which have been backing Haftar and the Libyan National Army, and the United States, Turkey, Italy, that have been backing the government of national unity. China wants to appear to be removed from all these foreign players meddling in Libyan internal affairs, and also to leverage its position internationally as a peacemaker, as an alternative voice to American hegemony and to European dominance of the Mediterranean and, you know, the affairs of the Middle East and North Africa. So it's a diplomatic element there. There's a political element, but there's also a strategic element. And as we know, China's a permanent member of the Security Council. So nothing can happen if China vetoes the UN mission in Libya. And I think that's another variant of this crisis that we should also be thinking about.
But in the realm of competing with Western forces and countries like the United States, they are called on the international community to continue to support efforts to seek African solutions to African problems and promote a political settlement to the Libyan issue. What do you make of that?
This is another play, diplomatic language of Russia, United States, back off Libya, that this is an African country. And really, the AU should be in the forefront of resolving these conflicts diplomatically. I think the challenge, as much as African, you know, solutions for African problems sounds lofty and sounds ideal, in practice, the reality is very different. The AU is largely funded by foreign donors. Ethiopia, where the AU is headquartered, is mired in its own internal civil war. There's a weakness and division among, you know, African leaders on their policy on a range of crises, including Libya. So it becomes very easy for foreign actors. So as much as China says that this should be an AU solution, I think even the Chinese themselves know that the AU does not have the military capacity to intervene in Libya. But I think in saying that, that there should be African solutions to African problems, the underlying theme there is foreign actors need to get out of Libya. And I think this is a message to the United States, to U.S. hegemony in the Mediterranean and in Libya in the post-Gaddafi dispensation, but also to other regional players like Turkey, like Egypt, and also like Russia, which have, you know, backed different factions in this crisis. And, you know, it really doesn't seem to be ending anytime soon, the problems in Libya.
The Chinese ambassador also called on all Libyan parties to put the interest of the country and people first, remain rational and restrained, continue to strictly comply with the ceasefire agreement. Is that feasible?
It will really depend on whether the Libyan leaders decide they want to continue to get the backing and support of foreign actors who are supporting the different factions. But I don't see the Libyan government or the different factions in Libya rejecting any kind of aid from the foreign actors. I think ultimately the crisis will have to be sorted out in some kind of compromise between the LNA and the government of national unity. China really insisting that Libyan leaders really need to put the country at heart. Sounds idealistic, sounds like the right thing to do. But what China's advocating is good for the diplomatic front, but I'm skeptical about whether it will work in practice on the ground. So it seems like this faction of division will continue in Libya for a long time to come.
That was David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York. He was speaking with my colleague, Mohamed El-Shenawi. Kenya is one of 16 African countries that have organized female gamers competitions this month. Kenya's competition attracted at least 10 female gamers competing for a chance to represent the nation in the Democratic Republic of Congo next month. Mohamed Youssef reports.
This year's female gaming competition in Kenya attracted 10 gamers compared to last year, where only one female was invited to compete. After more than 4 hours of tough competition, Kenya produced a winner who will represent the country in the Congolese capital, Kinshasa, where seven other national champions from seven African countries will compete against each other. Magdalene Mumbi, also known as Bambina in esports, has been playing the game since 2018 and was a favourite to win the competition. The players were playing a fighting game known as Tekken 8, where the players' attacking and defensive skills are tested.
I lost the very first game that I played, and I'm very excited. I made a comeback and won all my games throughout and also won the final game, the deciding match.
The competition aims to encourage more women to join the gaming industry, create diversity and fight toxic behavior that some in the community express against women. Derek Nyasio is tournament administrator of Swahili Esports Champions.
It's a great step forward, especially considering the local scene has been seeing, you know, like a male dominant section within esports. So that's for FIFA, that's for Tekken as well, and the fighting game community in general. So being able to have these opportunities where also ladies can have an opportunity to showcase their talent, to shine, to get a chance to also travel outside and represent the country, it boosts the self-esteem and the confidence to also show up for other events.
Douglas Ogeto is a business director for Africa Esports Championship.
There's a lot of women game out there, but because, you know, their parents might not approve of gaming, not many young women are coming out. So this is just one platform where which women can actually come to showcase their skills, of course get to travel, get to be exposed, and, you know, who knows, maybe also get to build a career out of it.
According to the Newzoo Games Analytics Company, 46% of game enthusiasts are female. However, the number may be lower in Africa. Abuse from male gamers and harassment are common difficulties faced by female gamers. The digital divide also exacerbates the inclusion of women. Evie Nungari, a geospatial engineering technology student, has fallen in love with esports after being introduced to it by one of her friends. After a year, she says she's improving, and in a year or two, she hopes to compete for a prize.
With every day learning the game, I'm making so much progress because right now I can compete with other females. I can also compete with males. So I'm making so much progress in learning how to use the sets.
It will take more than a competition to attract more women gamers. The gaming community knows it must also drive positive change by promoting diversity and inclusivity in the ever-expanding and growing esports sector. Mohamed Youssef, VOA News, Nairobi.
Since the U.S. Supreme Court sent the issue of abortion back to the states in 2022, Democrats have mobilized to protect abortion rights while Republicans have worked to restrict the procedure on religious and moral grounds. The issue is motivating voters to go to the polls this election year. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more from Nevada.
This is the next important step for Nevada to protect reproductive freedom and particularly our abortion rights in this state.
Voters here in Nevada aren't just deciding between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris for president. They're also voting on question six.
And we hope we vote yes on six. Thank you.
Laura Campbell is going door to door telling people why she thinks a yes vote on question six is so important. Campbell is the director of the National Organization for Women's Nevada chapter.
Abortion access actually saved my life more than once, and I just think it's important that after Roe v. Wade was overturned, that the state protects us.
But at an anniversary celebration for First Choice Pregnancy Services, a religious nonprofit providing alternatives to abortions, people like Deborah Costello are worried that question six will pass.
The fight could seem overwhelming. Millions and millions of dollars in our state supporting the abortion industry.
Nevadans already voted in 1990 to make abortion legal up to 24 weeks. But Democrats fear a second Trump presidency could overturn those rights, even though Trump says the issue should be left for each state to decide. If question six passes, the existing protections would become part of the state's constitution, making them even more difficult to remove.
We've seen lives are being lost across, 22 states have abortion bans, and we don't want that to happen in Nevada.
Jessica Ponce de Leon is a first-time U.S. voter. She planned to vote yes on question six and for Kamala Harris even before Campbell knocked on her door.
I don't think that the government should have any say over women's bodies or any of that. I definitely feel like women should have total control over their body.
Nevada is one of 10 states this election year to give voters the choice to decide how and when abortion should be legal. In past election years, putting that issue on the ballot has boosted voter turnout and benefited Democratic candidates up and down the ticket. Christian Mersch, a Brazilian immigrant who got pregnant in an abusive relationship and chose to keep her baby, is a board member of Nevada Right to Life.
Without life, there's no liberty, there's no other rights. If you don't respect life, there's going to be racism, human trafficking, and I just feel that we're disposable right now.
While the issue is motivating young voters, first-time voter Emily Costello says minds can be changed, and not all young voters will vote for Democrats.
If you can visually see how destructive that is to just a single human being, that'll change your mind instantly. Instantly.
A nationwide survey released this week by independent health polling source KFF says a growing number of women cite abortion rights as their top issue since Kamala Harris became the Democratic nominee for president. Katherine Gibson, VOA News, Las Vegas, Nevada.
And that wraps it up for us this Thursday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite program and news updates. For more news, head over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Break Your Back by Awilo. Listening to Break Your Back by Awilo. I am your host, Mukbil Yabaro, in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Bill Andrade, and producer, Kwame Ofori, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.